little bit there. And this was Ross Perot's 1992 presidential running mate. He was retired Vice Admiral James Stockdale. And he opened the vice presidential debate against Dan Quayle and Al Gore with the rhetorical questions, who am I, why am I here? And with a news media, of course, that looks for sound bites and loves to mock people, his words and his awkwardness with the limelight made him a laughingstock. Even on Saturday Night Live, they made fun of him. And his words are still quoted from time to time. They're actually, this little piece is a part of some college courses now on communication and politics, maybe. But Ross Perot's choice of Stockdale as a running mate caused many to question his judgment and felt that it destroyed the momentum that he had as a third-party candidate, you know, who almost had a real chance to win. Why would Perot pick someone who seemed to be barely able to speak as his running mate? Well, the truth is, Stockdale most likely was the smartest one on the stage, and he certainly was the one who had been proven most courageous. He was one of the most highly decorated officers in U.S. Navy history. He served as president of the Citadel, a military college in South Carolina, and then served as a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And during the Vietnam War, Stockdale was a Navy fighter pilot and flew 201 missions before he was shot down. And he became the highest ranking naval officer that was captured during the war. Stockdale was taken to Ho Lo Prison, which was known as Hanoi Hilton, and his shoulders were wrenched from their sockets. His leg had been shattered already by angry villagers and a torturer, and his back was broken, but he refused to give in. Rather than allow himself to be used in a propaganda film, Stockdale smashed his own face into a pulp with a mahogany stool. He said his only hope was to disfigure himself so that they wouldn't be able to show how well they were treating the prisoners and show off the fact that they had such a high-ranking officer as a POW. And it worked, but he spent the next 2 years in leg irons and spent a total of 4 years in solitary confinement. So ironically, I thought of Stockdale's words in connection with the unknown characters that surrounded Jesus after his trial. But Stockdale himself was more familiar with Jesus' position, you know, as the one who was mocked and beaten. But let's look at that scene now. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again, they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it, and they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. It was the third hour when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." Remember, Pilate had asked him whether he was. He confirmed that he was. So Pilate took him at his word. They crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. In whatever sense that we are created in the image of God, That reality does not include omniscience, one of the characteristics of God, the knowledge of all things. We start asking why at about the age of 3, and we never seem to grow out of that. It's one of those words like the word no that most kids seem to find enchanting at some point, you know, in their development. And unfortunately, we don't grow out of our enchantment with the word why. The only thing that changes is what we're asking about. Warum is the German word for why, and it is the name of one scholarly journal of philosophy that presumes to ask the big questions. Well, one of the whys that was a big part of our early married life was, why did God provide for us to go to Germany to plant a church, we thought, only then to allow our support to be pulled out from under us before we really did any real work there? Well, we have many more questions about things that have happened since then in our lives, right? And I'm sure you do too. But one thing we can do with these questions is to look for good things that come from the disappointments and thank God for those good things. The best thing that came from our unfulfilled dream was highlighted 3 years after we returned to America. But it came from the worst thing that had happened to either of us in our personal lives. The good thing was that we were able to be with Brenda's mother, and she was able to see Mindy grow from age 3 to age 5 and see Jeremy from birth until age 2. Because if we had been in Germany as planned, she would have been alone during the time that she was fighting cancer and died in that battle. And so she would have been alone possibly much of the 6 months that she suffered from cancer before she died. That's what happened a couple of years after we came back. Well, after the death of her older daughter, Rita, at age 3, and then the death of her husband 1 year later, it had been just Brenda and her mother for about 20 years before our marriage. Certainly had a lot of friends, a lot of church family friends. But Brenda's mother was the kind of independent non-whiner who would have probably, if we had been in Germany, and she couldn't, you know, she got cancer, would have downplayed it and said, don't bother about it, don't come home. Brenda probably would have gone home anyway, but if we had listened to her mother and she had said that, we came back to the States and lived only 3.5 hours from her by car in Memphis when we lost our support and when the bad news was revealed. So at first we all drove to see her most weekends. After that diagnosis. And then when she was in the hospital for the last 3 months of her life, Brenda and the kids stayed with my sister, who just happened to live near the hospital. And I drove over on weekends. Well, the great blessing in both the tragedy of the loss of our dream and the loss of Brenda's mother was that Brenda was able to be with her every day at the hospital for the whole 3 months. And the kids were even allowed to visit on the cancer floor. It was a very progressive hospital for that time. But cancer isn't contagious, and so they let people, even children, visit. So it's almost unbearable to think about Brenda's mother having, who would have spent those 3 months with only occasional visits from friends and her two brothers, because no one lived right there that was close to her. And that would have been how it would have been if we had been in Germany. Well, when we think of Jesus as God, we tend to think that he was omniscient, even as a human being. As an omniscient being, much of what happened to Jesus at this point might have seemed very insignificant. These fishermen and such types he's been hanging out with, well, they take off and leave him alone? So what? Does the God of the universe really need these guys? See, on one level, of course, the answer is no. He didn't need these guys. Jesus does not need them in order to be who he is in the sense that a coach needs a team to really be a coach, but as a human being, and he was, and he wasn't omniscient as a human being, Jesus seems to really want them to be with him. And he seems to grieve over the fact that they betray him and they leave him alone. As Jesus is facing death, he is not surrounded by his family or his friends. He is surrounded by strangers who don't even know him. There were some family and friends a ways off, but the ones right around the cross are strangers mostly who don't even know him and yet who seem to take pleasure in doing their best to deny that he is worthy of any dignity at all, much less worthy of sincere praise or honor. They mock him as if he were king, but it's clearly mocking. So who are these people? Why are they here? It seems like they are all there for no good reason. First of all, who are the soldiers? Why are they there? The soldiers may say, well, they're just there because it's their job to be there. They're just doing their job. Okay, but is it their job to mock him while they're there? The trial is over, so it doesn't even serve the purpose of breaking his will, you know, as torturers will, to get them to reveal some important strategic information. They're just pretending to show superiority by virtue of the fact that he has no recourse. He can't do anything about it. They can say or do anything to this guy who was supposed to be so important, and he can't do anything about it. Little do they know that he could have. He could say the word and put an end to them and to the whole charade. So if we find ourselves in a position like the soldiers were in, we need to remember that our job is to do our duty with humility. This is a position that those who work in the prison find themselves. You can pretend to be superior and treat the inmates like animals just because there's not much they can do about it. But parents, teachers, classmates, civil servants of all kinds, bosses, preachers, we're all in a position at some point where we are tempted to treat others as inferior beings. So there, but for the grace of God go I, is the attitude that should keep us on task. So next, who is this Simon? And why is he there? Who is this Simon who is forced to be his only helper? It's not his friend, Simon Peter. This is just Simon. He just happens to be passing by and the soldiers grab him. Now, by the way that Mark identifies his sons, Alexander and Rufus, yeah, it's probably true that they became followers of Jesus that are pretty well known, who are reading, you know, the followers of Jesus, you know, who are reading Mark's gospel initially, probably knew Alexander and Rufus, knew of them. And so that's why he names them. But they probably became followers of Jesus later, and Simon, I'm guessing, did as well, but we can only guess. At the time, he was just a certain man, just someone who was there. And so here's what this means for us. Even when we do not choose to serve, sometimes we're just thrust into a position where we have no clue what to do. You know, there's someone who's suffering something that we have no real training in dealing with, and yet we're just there. And but we can still carry burdens. We can't necessarily solve the problems, but we can carry burdens for others. Really, as much as we try to control what we do in life, we are really not in control of what happens and where we are. What we are in control of is how we respond to what is forced on us. Do we resist and build up resentment for having been put in that position? Or do we take it in stride and look for what good may come of it? Or maybe even see the good and take it on with joy and enthusiasm? Now, there's a concept that might change our lives. Okay, so next. Who are these other guys on the crosses? Why are they there? They certainly aren't the right and left-hand men of his kingdom. Remember how James and John had wanted to be at those places of honor? They actually asked Jesus whether they could be at his right and his left when he came into his kingdom, and Jesus had said that they would. And he indicated that they would indeed be baptized with the baptism he was baptized with. And this is it. This is his baptism. Or we might say the precedent to it, the death that precedes the burial. Okay, so this could have fulfilled their request and his prediction, James and John. But this was not the time for James and John to be baptized with the baptism he was baptized with. They probably were later on, traditionally. They were all crucified except for John and Paul, but he wasn't there yet. But James and John are not the ones at Jesus' right and left. Instead, those at his right and left were common criminals who had no ability to share a sense of purpose at this critical moment. In fact, they join in the mockery as if even they feel superior to Jesus. However, we cannot lift ourselves up by tearing others down. And that's what they were trying to do. We are not here to bring others down to our level. One of the messages about bullying that I emphasize in schools is that bullying is often an attempt to do just that. But it doesn't work. And some of our adult politicians need to learn this. It may make you feel good for a moment, but it doesn't make you feel better about yourself, really. And it doesn't make your world more secure in a practical sense. I mean, if you cripple someone else just because you've been crippled by others, whether it's them or someone else, what will happen when you or someone else needs help from someone with two good feet? You know, but you've crippled them, you're crippled already. And of course, crippling could be emotional or spiritual or physical. And we may need someone who emotionally or spiritually has both feet on the ground. And so, you know, we're not able to do that because we've been crippled. We just turned around and crippled someone else. So next, who are the chief priests and teachers of the law, and why are they there? Well, these are the only ones that Jesus may know by name, even if he doesn't know them personally, but some of them he's had personal encounters with, certainly, in the trial he has, but they're certainly not his friends. They are there at the cross only to verify that he actually is dead. And in their desperation and cowardice, they want to see this evil thing that they have accomplished with their own eyes. And since they are Sadducees who do not believe in life after death, they actually believe that they are changing the course of history. See, they thought that they had a better plan that would bring a better outcome, and they've accomplished it. Well, you know, we are not here because God needs help with his planning. What is his plan? How do we fit into it? In other words, who are we? Why are we here? Well, before we can answer that, we need to identify someone else. So let's go back to the story. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near, presumably who did not speak the language he was speaking in, They heard this and they thought, listen, he's calling Elijah. One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, and put it on a stick and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. This centurion had probably been there the whole trial, and the sentencing and the crucifixion was probably his job, right? He may have encountered Jesus at some point in the past. Maybe he had seen him do some of the wonders, or heard him speak, or he had heard others tell about their encounters. We don't know how much information he had exactly or how that information came to him, but do you suppose that maybe he even knew the centurion? Remember in Capernaum, which was Jesus' sort of headquarters for a time, that Matthew tells about, whose son was healed by Jesus? Remember that centurion? There weren't all that many centurions in the area. And it's quite likely that word got around among them. But just the events of that day would have been enough to convince any honest-hearted person of the answer to the question, who was Jesus? So to use the words of the opening song, Open the Eyes of My Heart, the centurion was honest-hearted and clear-eyed when he saw what happened, and he said, surely this man was the Son of God. What he could not know based on the events of that day, however, was the answer to the second question, why was he there? So we're going to explore the events that follow these in the next week or two, and we'll get to the question of who we are and why we are here in a little more depth. But today we're just going to sing as we wrap this up about at least an important part of the answer to that question as to why Jesus was there. So let's all stand together and let's sing.